This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Anthony Lewis sees the First Amendment's right to free speech and a free press as the key to American democracy. Those freedoms were laid out at the nation's birth, but Lewis argues that it took creative Supreme Court justices in the last century to expand those freedoms. Lewis's new biography of the First Amendment is titled Freedom for the Speech That We Hate. And this hour on Word for Word, we'll hear Anthony Lewis talk about the history of the First Amendment. He'll also talk about judicial activism versus judicial creativity and why he thinks the press didn't exercise their freedoms enough in recent years. The First Amendment and Bill of Rights have been both the tool for and the focus of Anthony Lewis's long career. In 1955, he began covering the Supreme Court and other legal issues for the New York Times. His 1964 book, Gideon's Trumpet, traced the High Court's decision that guaranteed criminal defendants the right to an attorney. Another book, Make No Law, dealt with a landmark Supreme Court decision on libel law. For 30 years, he was a columnist for the Times and leading liberal writer. He continues to write columns that appear on the op-ed page. On February 5th, Anthony Lewis spoke at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco. Actor Peter Coyote was the moderator and the friendly questioner, and he asked Lewis to explain how he came up with the book title, Freedom for the Speech That We Hate.
When I was covering for the Supreme Court for the New York Times, I very occasionally, and I mean not often, was invited to talk with one of the justices in his chambers. They were all his then. One day I went to see Justice Frankfurter, no secrets passed, just a chat. And he was irritable that day because some newspaper or commentator had said that he was insufficiently liberal, especially compared to his colleagues Hugo Black and William O. Douglas. And nothing could drive him up the wall more surely than to be unfavorably compared to his companions, his colleagues. He grumbled about that for a while. And then he said, liberal? I'll show you liberal. And he bounded up from his desk, stalked across the room, pulled a volume out from a wall of copies of the United States reports, the collections of Supreme Court opinions, opened it, handed it to me, and said, read. And I read. It was a dissenting opinion by Justice Holmes in a 1929 case called United States against Schwimmer. Rosika Schwimmer was a... It has to be a long answer, Peter.
We're happy with long answers.
Rosika Schwimmer was an immigrant from Hungary. She loved the United States and wanted to become a citizen, and she met the qualifications required, except that she was a pacifist, and she would not swear the oath required at that time, which would have made her swear that she would take up arms to defend the Constitution. She wouldn't say that as a pacifist. And she sued and lost in the Supreme Court, Holmes dissenting. And his dissent, he began his dissent in a sort of, I suppose, mildly sarcastic way that he said he rather doubted that she would be asked to take up arms because she was a woman of a certain age. Then he said, I don't agree with her about war. I know that war is terrible, but I think it has its noble aspects. He really did know that war was terrible. This was 1929, ladies and gentlemen, and Holmes had fought in the Civil War and been wounded gravely three times. He was 88 when he wrote this opinion. When he died a few years later, his friends found hanging in his closet his Union Army uniform. He knew about war. But, he said, if there is any provision of the Constitution that more imperatively calls for attachment than any other, it is freedom of thought. Not free thought for those who agree with us, but freedom for the thought that we hate. He could have stopped there and it would have been a wonderful dissent, but he didn't. He went on for about two more sentences. And he said, recurring to the opinion that bars this applicant's way, the Quakers, pacifists, have done their part in making this country what it is. And I had not thought before now that we regretted our inability to expel them because they believe more than some of us in the Sermon on the Mount. I want to tell you, sitting there in that chair when I came to that last sentence, the hair rose on the back of my neck. And I can't say it now without a very emotional feeling. Nobody wrote opinions like Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., and I don't think there's any judge anywhere or any time who could have written that sentence. Long answer.
No, it's the right answer. There's a certain kind of heroic perspective in your writing about the courts, and I mean that without irony. You review great men and great minds and great decisions. Let me jump. Well, before I get to today, do you think that when the Founding Fathers wrote the First Amendment, that their thinking was consonant with that decision that you just read? Do you think that's what they were thinking of?
I don't think they really focused on any particular set of facts or imagined that it would involve somebody who was an applicant for citizenship and wouldn't swear the oath. No, it wasn't like that. But the principal framer of the First Amendment, James Madison, had a very profound commitment to freedom of speech and freedom of the press. He really believed, and he lived in a time, the end of the 18th century, when newspapers in the United States, and they were little throwaway sheets, not great metropolitan dailies, but they were very vicious, often edited by party hacks who made nasty charges against opposing politicians. One of the writers for one of those papers was the inventor or the first public expounder of the Thomas Jefferson Sally Hemings story, for example. He didn't like that, but he was prepared to stand it and indeed believed and said that no comment could be about a political figure, about government, could be suppressed, even if false. That the answer to false or vicious speech was counter speech, and he really meant that. So I think it is consonant with Madison's view.
Leaping forward some centuries, in 2003, kind of uncharacteristically, a sitting jurist, Lord Johann Steyn, called Guantanamo prison a massive failure of justice, and in writing about that, you said, "The Bush administration is really attacking a basic premise of the American system, that we have a government under law." Do you remember that? And if so, what do you mean?
I well remember Lord Steyn's speech. It was from a speech that he gave. He also described Guantanamo as a black hole in the law, because it was a place where law didn't apply, and the United States claimed the right to hold these people in defiance of the Geneva Conventions, to which we are signatory, without any kind of hearing, process, any chance to say that, in fact, somebody had been picked up by mistake. And you know, the people who were there, more than half of them, were not people caught on the battlefield in Afghanistan. They were people who were turned over to American agents by Afghan warlords or people elsewhere. There was a large bounty for those people being turned over. I think $5,000, which was a hell of a lot of money in Afghanistan, is what you got if you turned over an alleged terrorist. Well, I don't know. Some of them undoubtedly were and are terrorists. But some of them undoubtedly were not. And more than half of those held have been returned now, finally, after years of captivity under very difficult circumstances. So, by definition, we decided they weren't terrorists after all. But the struggle to get them a hearing, any kind of an opportunity to say you've got the wrong guy and to be confronted with the evidence against them. Why do you say I'm a terrorist? Who told you that? They're not allowed to find out.
I think many people probably had the feeling that if they were normal law-abiding citizens, that transgressions like that didn't apply to them and that they were immune. But you went on to make the point that the Bush administration used similar methods against U.S. citizens and even argued that U.S. citizens have no greater protection under the law.
Two United States citizens were held in detention without trial, without access to counsel, without access to anybody, family, counsel, held in solitary confinement for several years. One was eventually returned, Yasser Hamdi, to Saudi Arabia. He was an American citizen, but he'd been living in Saudi Arabia. The other, Jose Padilla, was eventually removed from the status of an untried, uncharged detainee and prosecuted criminally. And as you probably know, he was convicted of an offense of conspiracy to aid terrorism in some way, and his case is on appeal now. But his, I should simply add, in fairness to Padilla, that his treatment during the years of detention was evidently pretty shocking. At least the judge at the trial said that she had to take it into account in sentencing him because he was treated so badly. The claim is that he was sort of denied sensory access to his senses. That is, that he was under lights 24 hours a day all the time, given medicines of an unknown kind, or drugs, I should say, and kept in the way some of the prisoners at Guantanamo have been kept. So I thought and think it's a very black mark. It occurred to me after I finished the answer to the previous question that I should have said something. You mentioned the period in the McCarthy years when Americans were charged, like my eventual friend Abraham Chazanow, were deprived of their jobs, their livelihood, as happened in your family, without being told the reasons or told the name of the person who charged them with doing something wrong. Well, that's exactly what's happened to the detainees in Guantanamo. It's the same thing.
So would you say that the press is living up to its responsibilities to, or do you feel that the press has a responsibility to be a watchdog of the fundaments of American civil society, that they should be watching out for the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and alerting the citizenry to impending threats? Or is that just a pipe dream of lefties like myself?
The answer to your question, in a word, is yes, I do believe that. It's not a pipe dream, unless you want to accuse Madison of being a pipe dreamer. That's exactly what he thought and wrote, that the function of the press was to be to keep the government honest, to hold the government accountable. He said in a political system, and they were creating a political system of a novel kind, a republic with no king. And in that kind of political system, he said, the ultimate sovereigns, to wit, the people, have to know what the government is doing. Otherwise, how can they exercise their responsibility to vote, to elect, to ultimately govern the society? And so he said that's the responsibility of the press, to keep the government accountable, to tell the people what the government is doing. And he really meant it.
Well, do you feel like the press is fulfilling that responsibility?
Well, I hoped you'd ask that question.
So if not, why not?
Well, it's really a double answer. In the period after 9/11, the press did not live up to that responsibility, not by far. The press sort of went to sleep. It censored itself, and it seemed to be afraid to challenge the government in the run-up to the war, the invasion of Iraq, the war in Iraq. And we don't have to take my word for that having happened, because the New York Times and the Washington Post both, a year or two later, published apologies, actual printed apologies in the newspaper for their being asleep at the switch during the run-up to the war in Iraq and not looking into the claimed reasons for the war, which, as we now know, were false. That, as was said by many people in the government, Saddam Hussein had been part of the attack on 9/11, that he had weapons of mass destruction, and so on, all things that didn't turn out to be true. And the press wasn't doing its job. Now, I want to say, in fairness, that it has turned around. In more recent years, the press, I think, has been doing a terrific job. The New York Times, for example, reported a very difficult story to get the order of President Bush to wiretap our international conversations in violation of a criminal law without warrants. The Washington Post had a wonderful story about secret CIA prisons in Europe. Both have had stories about torture.
Do you think that when I was a boy, my dad would bring home about 7 newspapers every night? There'd be the New York Times and the Daily Mirror and the Daily News and the New York Post and the Journal American and the Herald Tribune. And each one had a kind of perspective. And
not the World Telegram?
I forgot the word. Thank you. But somewhere out of the free-for-all of the contending points of view, a lot more information seemed to be available for public discourse. And I'm wondering if you can identify a point. Was there a point or was there a sliding scale where the newspapers began to kind of fall off their task as watchdogs, or a set of circumstances that propelled them to do that?
Well, it's a rather complicated question, actually. Two things happened. One, economic pressures brought about gradually and acceleratingly the amalgamation of newspapers. It became the World Telegram, the Sun. We forgot about the New York Sun, too. The World became the World Telegram and Sun, and then the Herald Tribune and the World Telegram and Sun, and so on and so on. The Mirror dropped out, and the Herald Tribune dropped out. That was really a tragic loss because it was a very interesting newspaper. But I want to tell you, lest we get too romantic, and I am a romantic about all these matters, that the papers we respect today were not great challengers of the government at that time and for years later. The real tipping point came during Vietnam. When I grew up in Washington as a reporter, it was the common assumption of the Washington Press Corps, including my revered boss, Scotty Reston, that the government, people in the government were deserving of high respect. They operated in good faith. They were much better informed than we were, and hence one had to, you know, pay attention to them and pay them respect. Well, that went out the window in Vietnam. A, they didn't tell the truth. They didn't talk in good faith. And B, they didn't know more than we did. In fact, the correspondents in Vietnam, Neil Sheehan and David Halberstam and the rest, knew much more about the reality in Vietnam than Lyndon B. Johnson or Robert McNamara. They fooled themselves. The reporters did not. They didn't go there knowing what they would find. Halberstam went there thinking he was for the war. And, you know, he went out a few times and saw what was happening and said, "Now, this isn't working. This is a bad idea." But that didn't penetrate official thinking in Washington for a long, long time. And so I think that was the turning point, symbolized by the Pentagon Papers episode when the New York Times, very unusually for it, very unusually, decided, and that means the publisher decided, to print the secret history of the origins of the Vietnam War that had been compiled by the Defense Department at McNamara's suggestion or order. That was a kind of challenge, you know, to print dozens and dozens of pages of text of top secret documents. The New York Times didn't used to do that. It was in hand in glove with the government, and it just got off the track because of Vietnam.
We're listening to a recent appearance by author Anthony Lewis at the Commonwealth Club of California. Leading the conversation with Lewis is actor Peter Coyote. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
I know that you have a kind of ambiguous feeling about the Shield Law, and I'd like you to talk about the First Amendment and whether you feel it applies to reporters in their work as well as to ordinary citizens, or if it applies in the same way.
Well, of course, it applies in many ways, but it has never been held to apply, and I see if I can make this clear, because it is a bit tricky, to the acquisition of news. The Pentagon Papers, which was really the determinative case about all this, was about the right to print news that you had. We had the papers. We simply wanted to tell the public what was in them. There was no question of acquiring them or acquiring the information. We had it. We, the New York Times. Not me, I was in London. But the Supreme Court has never found that the First Amendment gives the press or anybody the right to acquire information against the objection of the government. You can't go waive the First Amendment and go to the Supreme Court and say to the justices, "I want to sit in on your private conferences and discover what you're going to decide a few months down the road." You can't do that. That won't do you any good. There's a narrow exception. The court has held that the public does have a right to attend criminal trials. Mm-hmm. Because of historical precedent, trials have always been open, so the court said, so we will read the First Amendment to incorporate a right to attend trials. And the argument for giving reporters the right to keep secret, to refuse to disclose the names of confidential informants, which is what we're talking about here, is a branch, a subset of the right to acquire news. The argument is that we have a right to acquire news, and the use of confidential informants is an important aspect of that right. We have to have confidential informants to acquire information. Well, it's a very hard argument to make historically, and it hasn't succeeded. The Supreme Court has rejected that argument and held that the Constitution, the First Amendment, does not protect the use of confidential informants, or does not protect reporters from having to disclose to a grand jury or in a libel case or whatever who their informant was. Now, I have mixed feelings, as you say, and I'm not very popular with press lawyers because I'm not a gung-ho advocate of the right, of a legal right to refuse to disclose all the time. I want to make one thing clear. A reporter who promises a source to keep the name confidential absolutely must do so. It not only do so as a matter of professional ethics and honor, but because he's legally bound to do so. You can't give up a name if you promise not to do it. But what's the result? Is the reporter going to be protected in his refusal to give up the name, or will he or she, like Judith Miller, go to prison for contempt of court? That's the bottom line. Well, I have mixed feelings for this reason. Well, I should say, the issue is not dead, though the Supreme Court has said the Constitution doesn't protect the journalist. Because, as you said, there's a shield law under consideration in Congress, a federal shield law. There are lots of state shield laws, including in California. There's never been a federal shield law, which is a big lack because a lot of the important cases, for example, about government leaks and whistleblowers are federal matters, and the absence of a federal shield law is quite disabling in the way I've been talking about. But I'm still doubtful about an absolute protection for journalists for the following reason. You all probably remember the case of Wen Ho Lee. Wen Ho Lee was a physicist who was at the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Newspapers and some broadcast station began publishing, saying, on the basis of leaks from supposedly informed government sources, that he was actually a spy for China, and he was turning over nuclear information to China. Well, you can imagine that had a rather devastating consequence on Wen Ho Lee's career and life. And he was in due course, of course, indicted on 60 counts of espionage and other very serious charges. Eventually, the government withdrew 59 of the 60 counts, and he pleaded guilty to one count of misusing information that had been retroactively classified. He then sued the government for invasion of privacy in the leaks, the erroneous leaks, we have to assume, since the government dropped the charges, to the press. And he inevitably needed to know, in order to maintain his lawsuit, the names of the leakers. Who told the press this? One or more leakers. Who were they? Well, that's how you have to... You can't win the lawsuit unless you can know that. So what did he do? You can guess. He asked the reporters, and you can guess what they said. We're not going to tell you. So they went to the trial judge and said, we don't have to tell him. We have a constitutional right not to tell him. And as I've told you, that didn't fly, and the judge rejected the claim. And in due course, the papers settled, and the broadcast stations settled the case by paying Wen Ho Lee $800,000, and the government paid him $600,000 toward his legal fees. Now, my question is this. Would it be a good society if somebody whose life had been effectively destroyed, his reputation, his livelihood, had no recourse for that? Is that what we want so the press can be protected? I don't want it, I have to tell you. So I would not favor a shield law that protected the accusers of Wen Ho Lee. I think there has to be some accommodation for the interest of a person whose life has been destroyed. That would not apply, in my thought, to a journalist who discloses important wrongdoing by the government. That's not what happened here. The case in point is going on right now. The reporter for the New York Times, James Risen, was subpoenaed by a federal grand jury in New York and told he must name his sources for a chapter of a book he wrote about the CIA. Who were your sources in the CIA? Well, I would not allow that information to be compelled from him, because I think the public interest in keeping track of the often lawless behavior of the CIA is more important than the government's interest in knowing who the sources are. That's a balance. How is it to be struck? The way it's always struck, by judges. And that's the way I would deal with it.
You raise a question that has a lot of import, which is, namely, the integrity of the referees. And there are a number of people who feel, for instance, that since the 2000 election, that the Supreme Court was turned into an instrument of politics, that by establishing the election and declaring it without precedent and simply saying this is a one-off situation, we're giving the election to President Bush this time, but we're not writing new law, that it...
Just wholesale, that's all.
Yeah, right. That it actually weakened the integrity of the judicial system, that it calls into question the fairness and integrity of the referee in this case. And so by the same way that you accused President Bush of, challenging the principle of one country under the law, how do you feel about this? I mean, do you feel that these are imperiled times for the judiciary?
Well, there are really two questions there. One is about the decision in Bush against Gore in 2000, which I thought was a disastrous decision for the reputation of the court. As you really explained, I don't need to repeat it. The other is what's become of the court, not in the last 7 years, but in the last 1 year, with the appointment, or it's a little more than 1 year now, of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. Well, the court has turned very sharply to the right. Last year, it effectively overruled 10 precedents, each one in ways dear to the hearts of the far right, about abortion law, affirmative action, labor law, equal employment rights, and so on and so on, taking the right-wing position in each of these cases, each decided by a vote of 5-4. So there is a radical change going on in a way that's quite surprising to me, because usually the court, as I've said earlier, I'm a romantic about the Supreme Court, and I've always said to myself that I will be for it no matter what it does. My belief is being tested these days because it's not behaving the way the Supreme Court usually does, which is to change things very slowly. That doesn't always happen. It doesn't happen on the right or the left. Sometimes there's a dramatic change. But to do it, in 10 cases in one term of the Supreme Court was pretty wholesale. And there's no reason to think that it has stopped. So I'm not filled with, happiness about where the Supreme Court is today.
So let me just ask you generally. Yes, you have great faith in the judiciary, but if we look back historically, isn't it fair to say that many of the great social changes were initiated not by the courts but by engaged citizens, and that it was not the courts, let's say, that protected communists in the 1920s or the 1950s, that in fact a lot of the progressive changes were kind of forced upon the political system by citizen engagement?
It's some of each, I think. You're quite right that the court did not rise to the support of radical speakers in the 20s, not only communists, but anarchists, socialists, and others. Notably, the case that's the most bothersome was the first case in which Justice Holmes dissented in 1919. It was the first opinion ever written that treated freedom of speech and press as a fundamental right. It was a dissent. And it's a dissent in which Holmes said, again with his incredible rhetoric, that we must allow opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death. Isn't that an amazing sentence from a Supreme Court opinion? Holmes and Brandeis continued to dissent through the 1920s. And they had an impact. Their rhetoric, it was only two voices, but their words were powerful. And they persuaded, I think they had a very big impact in persuading the country and persuading the court. And in 1931, for the first time, 140 years after the First Amendment was added to the Constitution, the court sustained a claim under the First Amendment's free expression clauses. In fact, two that year. So it's a mix of the court and the country.
Anthony Lewis is author of Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. He has spent decades writing for the New York Times and spoke February 5th at the Commonwealth Club of California. You're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Anthony Lewis was joined in San Francisco by actor Peter Coyote, who posed his questions along with those from the audience.
The next question, actually, a question from the audience segued with a question of my own, so I'm going to ask it as a two-part question. The administration's made a kind of wholesale assault on the law, and they've attacked it on so many fronts, and they've kept everybody so busy. If you're like me, you're just kind of whirling, wondering which fire to put out next. So can you really imagine a future administration of either Democrat or Republican giving up these gains, giving up this kind of imperial presidency? And the question from the audience refines it to say, in order to reestablish the rule of law, does the next administration need to hold the Bush administration accountable for its violations of law?
Well, I'll answer the second part first and simply say that while my heart might beat a little louder if somebody was held accountable, I don't think it's likely to happen because presidents and administrations really want to look forward and don't want to engender more animosity. There'll be plenty from the other side anyway, so I don't think they'll do that. But the first part of the question is a very profound one. Just say your question again, so I'm sure I have it in mind.
Okay. Simply, can you imagine future administrations
whether
giving up the gains of the imperial presidency?
It's difficult to imagine it because presidents of either party like power. And this presidency has an extraordinary, very raw grasp for power, emanating in good part from Vice President Cheney's office and his former counsel, now Chief of Staff, David Addison, who believes that the president can do virtually anything alone, who has an utmost contempt for Congress, and thinks it ought to keep its nose out of public business and let the president govern. It's really extraordinary that, you know, we did have a revolution against George III, but Mr. Addison seems to have forgotten that. I don't know whether it's possible. I think it can certainly be better than it is today, but I'll tell you this. I have a secret desire, a secret wish, and that is that whoever is elected president of either party says in his inaugural address, this government is going to return to the principles laid down at the founding of this society, and we're going to have a government of laws, not men. I would like to hear that.
How do you feel about the way in which new technology may be affecting even whether or not cases reach the courts or not? And I'm thinking specifically about a recent case where Verizon Telephone Company refused to transmit some text messages from NARAL because of the political content. And this seems like this is not going to go to the courts. It seems like this is in the purview of the FCC and Congress, and we're in some kind of gray area here.
Well, what's frustratingly important to understand is that the freedoms of speech and press guaranteed by the Constitution in the First Amendment and applied to the states by the 14th apply only to provide protection only against repression by the government, official repression. It doesn't help you if you're repressed by Verizon or by any other corporation. And many corporations do things that I don't like. They withdraw sponsorship. They do what Verizon did. or what Yahoo did in identifying to the Chinese government a web user in China who was thereupon arrested. But the Constitution does not provide any recourse against private as opposed to official action. The FCC, I suppose, could in some theory act against what Verizon did, but I tell you honestly, I wouldn't want to stand on one leg until the FCC took such action. It's not going to. The FCC is too preoccupied with its role as national nanny in fining networks vast hundreds of thousands of dollars because of Janet Jackson's wardrobe malfunction. That's the level of concern of the FCC, I'm sorry to say.
We have an interesting question from the audience asking you, is there any tension between the defense of free speech and thought that we hate on the one hand and criminal enhancements for hate crimes motivated by race, for instance, or sexual identity on the other hand?
It's a good question, and it's a close one for me. But I come down saying that I come down believing that enhancement of sentences is okay. It's a very different thing from punishing speech because of its hateful character. The enhancement process is when an ordinary crime has been committed, like murder or assault. Let's say assault, and it's shown that you assaulted somebody because of his race or religion or whatever. And the state happens to have an enhancement statute in which which says that an assault with a hateful motive can be punished more severely. That's different from punishing a hateful speech as such. I think we have to allow hateful speech, with a single exception the Supreme Court has allowed, which is the urging of violence that you intend to come about imminently and that is likely to come about imminently. That can be punished. But I would allow, with some skepticism, some doubts, I must admit, the enhancement process.
There's been a lot of talk about the politicization of the judicial branch by the current administration. But isn't it true that the U.S. Supreme Court has always played something of a political role and has not been exempt from political pressures?
Absolutely. We don't want to be too naive about this. I regret what's happened to the court in the last year or two, as I've said. The framers of the Constitution provided a method for appointing Supreme Court justices and other federal judges, which ties the appointments to the political system. The president makes the appointments, and he's going to make appointments that he likes. Franklin Roosevelt didn't appoint conservative judges. He appointed seven liberal judges in a row. And it's a game that can be played by both sides. So I have to say it's not totally novel. I don't like it, what's happening now, not at all. And I think the appointments have been pretty far out of the mainstream, but that they're unconstitutional or something like that, no. That's the way the system works. What's different is this. There is one different thing that we should remember. Robert Jackson was a great lawyer, great American lawyer, who was one of the last important figures in American law who never went to law school but was trained as a clerk in a legal office, came from Jamestown, New York, and became Solicitor General in the Roosevelt government, and then Attorney General, and then a Supreme Court Justice. And just before he went on the bench, or maybe it was after he was already on the bench, he wrote a book about the court in which he said, "Never for a single moment has the Supreme Court represented anything but the most conservative instincts in American society." And that had been rather true from the beginning, but it wasn't true after 1937, which was the year of the first Roosevelt appointment. It began to change, and the court that decided Brown against Board of Education did not represent the most conservative elements in American society, nor that same court that applied the protections in the criminal law, the right to counsel, the right not to be compelled to give evidence against yourself. All those other rights, which had formerly been only valid against the federal government, applied them to state abuses as well. That wasn't a conservative court. So we've had a change. We've come in the last couple of generations to expect liberating, novel, socially reformist ideas from the Supreme Court. That didn't used to happen. On the contrary, the Supreme Court was an institution that often blocked social reform.
I'm just younger enough than you to ask this question.
Please.
As a student of the first of the Bill of Rights, you also must be a student of the history of repression. And so,
history of
repression.
Repression, yes.
And so sometimes I wonder, our thing, if we look, take a historical perspective, are things today as bad as people like myself think they are? Or have they been this bad at other times? I mean, was it as bad in World War II? Was it as bad during the Civil War? And it might be useful to get some perspective.
You want me to be a little more gloomy?
No, I want you to put things in a perspective to help me determine if I'm being an alarmist and just on a general bummer, or whether things are really in a worrisome pass.
I think they're worrisome, especially on the matters we discussed before, the use of torture, the detention of foreigners and Americans without trial, wiretapping without warrants in violation of a criminal statute. Those things are very worrying to me, and they're all examples of the rush for presidential power, unreviewable presidential power, mm-hmm. that you spoke of. But we've been through some very bad times before. I remind you that, you know, the case in which Holmes spoke of opinions that we loathe and believe to be fraught with death, that was the conviction of a little group of radicals who threw pamphlets from the top of a building in New York criticizing President Wilson for sending troops to Russia after the Bolshevik Revolution. Political criticism of a president. They were prosecuted under the Espionage Act, convicted and sentenced to 20 years in prison for those little pamphlets. Political criticism. It's amazing. Others were prosecuted in a terrible way. We had the Japanese relocation program, the Japanese Americans taken from the West Coast in World War II, which the Supreme Court upheld. Hardly our finest hour. And there have been a lot of other, the McCarthy years, which you know personally about. And, you know, it's not the first time bad things have happened in this country. I don't mean to say I'm not worried. I am. But it's not unique.
Well, from where I sit, there's a perhaps a more insidious pressure on free speech. Someone from the audience asked me to ask you how you would define an activist judge. And it led me to think, yeah, the people who are calling activists, judges activists have generally been neocons and right-wingers, and the appointees to the Supreme Court are extremely activist judges, overturning case law left and right. And it seems to me one of the restraints on free speech that is particularly pernicious is the way that the press has been tarnished as liberal. And anything that's left of a right-wing perspective is called liberal, and the press has fallen over itself to prove that it's not, and essentially shrunk the debate from the center to the right. And I wonder if you think I'm correct in this observation.
I think there's a lot to what you say. I think the right-wing talk shows and the people who talk about activist judges have pushed the debate to the right, undoubtedly, and it's quite worrying. I want to say a word about the phrase activist judges. It's actually an utterly meaningless phrase. It's supposed to imply judges who will decide things unanchored to precedent or reason, but just arbitrarily out of their own preferences. That's the implication, and the suggestion is that that's only done by liberal judges. Well, if that's what it means, and I think it actually means only an activist decision is only a decision you don't agree with, in fact. That's what I think it means. But anyway, if you took the definition seriously, what's the most activist decision of all time? Bush against Gore. Nobody can doubt that. You said it earlier, and you're right. It was a decision without any precedent, which the court said you don't have to pay any attention to in any further case. It was completely arbitrary and ridiculous. But you have to remember this. Put aside that meaningless term activist, and let's substitute bold or creative judges. We wouldn't have the First Amendment we have today if we didn't have bold and creative judges. You know, the First Amendment lay unenforced on the Constitution for 140 years. And then for 60 years after 1931, it was vigorously, creatively, wonderfully expanded till it covered all sorts of activities, including burning flags and carrying a red flag down the street. That was a crime in California. And, you know, many things just all over the map that were protected by the First Amendment, thanks to what judges did, creative judges. So we don't want to be too quick to object to creative judges. One of the great decisions was made in this state by a wonderful judge, Roger Traynor. It's long ago. People don't remember it. But it was at a time when the idea of people of different races marrying each other or having sex together was so sensitive that the justices of the Supreme Court did a dance, literally, to avoid deciding that whether they could constitutionally be prevented from marrying people of a different race. The Supreme Court ducked the issue of miscegenation for years until Judge Traynor, decided that the Constitution did not allow the punishment of people because they were of different races and they married. And, it turned out the sky didn't fall, and the Supreme Court adopted that view. And that was creative judging and brave judging. And I don't think the word activist has any place in the lingo.
You piqued my interest, and I wonder if you could give us a little bit of the history of it and the decisions that, I mean, why was it so kind of ignored by the Supreme Court, and what decisions brought it into prominence and propelled it forward as it is today?
The reasons for it are not entirely clear, except that judges simply did not think freedom of speech was a fundamental legal value. They may have felt that Americans were given to speak freely, and that was true, that we've always been a free-spoken people. But the idea of enforcing that as a right, a legal right, was novel and wasn't done. People, even Justice Holmes in earlier cases, said you could restrict free speech just as you could restrict, I think he gave the analogy of, you could make people vaccinate their children even if they objected to it. He didn't put the interest any higher than the objector to vaccination, that of the objector to vaccination. And then suddenly in 1919, and it was very sudden and very surprising, Justice Holmes saw the light and began with these powerful dissents, which eventually persuaded a lot of people, he and Brandeis. Why it happened exactly when it did, the accident of who was on the Supreme Court and the rhetorical power of those justices, Brandeis as well as Holmes, it's hard to say. The country was becoming more sophisticated and more civilized about that issue. The American Civil Liberties Union was founded in the stresses of World War I when these terrible prosecutions began to take place. The Second Sedition Act, the Sedition Act of 1918, Wilson's doing. I'll just throw in for what it's worth. I was brought up thinking Woodrow Wilson was a wonderful progressive president. He was actually the worst civil libertarian president in American history. Terrible, really awful, and very bad on race, too, a racist. So don't have any romantic visions about Woodrow Wilson. I don't know. That's neither here nor there. It seemed to happen as if suddenly it caught fire. Mm-hmm. And beginning in 1931 with the red flag case, Yetta Stromberg walking down the street in California waving a red flag, and she was prosecuted and convicted, and the Supreme Court reversed her conviction the first time, a blow for free speech. And later that same year, Neer against Minnesota, the court saving a newspaper that had been repressed in Minnesota, the first time freedom of the press had been vindicated. And then it began rolling along. And all kinds of cases came in rapid sequence. It's just like a flood had been released from a dam.
We've reached that point in our program where we're down to the last question. And this is kind of a generic question about the inherent tension that kind of operates in any reporter's daily work. And that is the tension between speaking truth to power and protecting the access to high officials that can guarantee your job. And I'd be really interested in hearing anything you had to say about that.
It's a wonderful question. It's a fundamental problem in the Washington Press Corps, especially nowadays, because as I say in the book, journalists, and they were only called reporters then, not journalists, used to be sort of scallywags. And they, you know, I don't know how many of you know the play The Front Page. Well, that's the way they used to be, you know, drinking whiskey out of paper cups in the City Hall press room and hiding escaped criminals in the roll-top desk and all the other fantasies of The Front Page. But there was, that's what it was like. Well, nowadays, most reporters, first of all, they're journalists now. Secondly, they, most of them have college degrees, virtually all, and many have graduate degrees. And they think of themselves as on a level with the Secretary of State and the Attorney General. And they're very self-important, and I probably include myself in that category. I mean, how can I escape? Access is terribly important. That's one reason when I began writing columns for the New York Times when I was in London. When I came back to this country, I decided at the last minute that I didn't want to live in Washington because I was too afraid. I knew my own limitations, and I was too afraid of being seduced by the access question, being too kind to politicians because I needed access to them. And I was going to be sitting next to the wife of the Secretary of State at some dinner party, and I couldn't be mean to the Secretary of State. I was just afraid that I would think that way. I don't know whether I would have, but I think I might have. And it's a real problem. Less so today than a few years ago. I think today's younger journalists are hardened, and they've had such bitter experience at the hands of this present administration that they're not cozying up to it so much.
Anthony Lewis, he has spent more than 50 years writing for the New York Times and twice won a Pulitzer Prize, including one for his coverage of the Supreme Court. His new book is Freedom for the Thought That We Hate, a biography of the First Amendment. He spoke about it with actor Peter Coyote on February 5th at the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco. If you missed part of Anthony Lewis's conversation, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. You have a number of options there. You can hear this week's show, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and listen to any of our previous programs, including Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer offering a view inside the court, Dinesh D'Souza offering the view that liberalism empowers terrorists, and legal analyst Jeffrey Rosen on how brain science could affect the justice system. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penn-Kava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.